Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to Continued Success, a Phillies podcast where we discuss the Phillies of the present, who are bad, and the Phillies of the past, who are good sometimes. But in the past we discuss, they are good and nothing can change that because history, Liz, is unchangeable. I'm Justin Clue, the current managing editor of The Good Fight. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports, and we talk about all sorts of Phillies on this podcast. We talk about the 1993 Phillies. We're going to talk about the 2008 Phillies. Today, we're going to focus on the 1993 NLCS and the end of that NLCS. We actually started talking about this two episodes ago, then switched over to 2008 NLCS or DS. You know what? I can't keep track of this anymore. We're talking about the playoffs that happened in those 2 years. In 1993, they obviously were a team everybody was watching. 2008, same thing. This week, we'll focus on the early 90s team because there's only so much you can pack into one podcast. Before we get into any of that, hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin.
So what's in the news today? Anybody up to anything in the NL East that's maybe worth discussing?
The Mets are about to hire an agent as their, I'm going to say, president of baseball operation.
Yeah, what's, I don't know, that seems, I don't know, new? Is it unprecedented? I mean, is that fair?
It's been done before, but it's just, it's a very Mets thing to do.
It kind of feels like a just tell us what to do kind of situation, you know? Like, fuck it, yeah. Just somebody tell us what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to find a list of his candidates, but it's...
And if we need Jacob DeGrom, yeah, who's good on this team? DeGrom? Who's in charge of DeGrom, his agent? Get him in here. I bet he could turn this whole team into a bunch of DeGroms.
Yeah, I think it's DeGrom. I think he might be Yoenis Cespedes. I think he might be his manager.
DeGrom's like, look, if I can't get off this team, then I'm going to be in charge of it. And so he's got his own guy running the team from the office.
He put together Robinson Cano's contract, his $240 million 10-year contract with the Mariners. He's the co-head of CAA Sports Baseball Division. So it's like I think he has a lot of Mets clients. And, you know, I guess, you know, they feel comfortable because they work with him. But it seems just like an extraordinarily bad idea.
What do you think is better?
On every level, really.
The very little we've heard from the Phillies so far since their season ended, or the way too much we've heard about the Mets since their regular season ended?
I'd rather almost nothing than this, because this is embarrassing.
At least our imaginations can run wild about what the Phillies are doing right now, instead of, again, having all too clear a picture of what exactly is going on with the Mets. We're like laughing condescendingly now. This is exactly, I feel like this is exactly how we set up the Mets like winning the NL East next year. Like trouncing the Phillies, a team we keep like we were so proud of that started this year and then wound up not even in second place. But still, I mean, come on. They're hiring Jacob DeGrom's agent. And I just heard about this information before we started recording. So I don't even feel like I'm fully grasping the motivations here or why exactly this would happen other than the ones I've generated myself. But that just seems weird. Seems weird to me. Seems like a weird move.
Well, I mean, I think we'll see some stuff. We'll find out what's going on as we, I mean, he has to ditch a lot of his clients, But if Jacob DeGrom gets a long-term expensive deal from the Mets, like this, none of this looks good. Why are they doing this? Why are they doing this?
How would you feel if the Phillies announced that Aaron Nola's agent was now the president of team operations?
I don't. But why would they even do that?
Weird. I would feel weird. Yes. I think some answers would be expected. And yeah, you know, a little incestuous, I guess. Just a little strange. What is the result of that? What is the goal of it? Who benefits? Look for the money. Where's that flowing? That sort of thing. I don't know. It's a strange situation. One that I certainly do not fully understand yet. But hey, look, it's the Mets. They're going to do stuff like this. They've been doing stuff like this, and somehow we still wind up talking about it. So, you know, maybe it'll all work out. Maybe this is the year, Liz, for the Mets.
Oh, the Mets have been saying that for a long time, and it's only been true twice.
The NL East. I mean, how would you characterize the NL East right now? I mean, we've got a couple of teams on the rise, some rising faster than others. The Nationals were supposed to be like the fallen old guard, but now they're kind of just sort of a middling group that even when they lose Bryce Harper isn't going to be too terrible. The Marlins are sort of a taken apart car that's still being asked to run, I guess. The Mets are a disaster, and the Phillies are just in a weird spot.
I'm imagining Derek Jeter getting into like a car on four cement blocks, just you know, moving the wheel around, like waving at people who are just walking by. I'm like, I'm on my way to work.
Just making engine noises with his mouth. Or like looking
at
looking at a mechanic and just being like, no, something's wrong. Something's weird. And the mechanic just looks like from the table that the engine is sitting on and back to the car. Like, what's okay?
Sir, you need a new car.
You know what we need to do?
Like an entirely new car.
We need to change the air freshener. That's the issue here. Let's get a new one of those in, and I'll take care of that. No problem. Let's ship all these parts up to New York. They'll know what to do with them.
Actually, our good friend Matt Winkleman said in our Slack just now, imagine your defense attorney becoming the DA.
There you go. There's the
because that's exactly what this is. Because instead of working for his clients, which, by the way, include Noah Syndergaard, Todd Frazier, and Tim Tebow, in addition to the other guys I mentioned. Like, that's the core of the Mets right there.
Yeah.
Like, this seems really weird. I don't understand it, and I'm sure no one at Major League Baseball is going to bat an eye, but I just don't see this working. Shockingly, I don't think this is going to work out that well for the Mets.
Can you imagine Major League Baseball having a reaction? Like this being the thing that they're upset about? That would be amazing. That'd be more historic than what's actually going on, I think. Well, Liz, about this time, probably a little earlier than this time, but about this time in 1993, what was going on was the National League Championship Series. And we all know how this ends, but it's really interesting going back and looking at these games and remembering exactly what comprised them. And a couple of things that surprised me was that the key role Kim Batiste plays as a member of the Phillies in keeping this series alive and keeping their season alive, the implications for the future that Mitch Williams' appearances had, that in seeing these games kind of act as a, I don't know. I mean, I know everyone knew Mitch Williams was a pretty risky pitcher as a closer, but you know, if he had won the World Series with them, that's what everyone would remember about him. But now it seems silly to be like, oh, well, you know, there were plenty of signs that he probably, you know, was fully capable of blowing a lead. And I think anyone would be like, well, yeah, of course there was. But as Jim Fregosi said at the time, he's our closer. And this wasn't the kind of team that made changes this late in the season. Certainly not with like how buddy-buddy everybody was and how old school everybody was, throwback everybody was. So, you know, looking at these games and, of course, watching the commercials in between the actual baseball, it paints a really interesting picture, which is to say that everyone should go back and watch commercials from the early 90s when any chance you get, because those are probably the most fun part of this, actually. And we'll get to those.
Oh, they're so much fun. Oh, my God. They really are my favorite.
Did you know Kathleen Turner was the voice of Diet Dr. Pepper?
Diet Dr. Pepper? No, she was the voice of MCI for a while. Did you know that Martin Sheen was the voice of Toyota?
That one I would not have guessed. And I would have thought he got like an investment.
And Eli, when
something.
You get, I've watched a couple of World Series games, and I have so many notes about the commercials in those. But yes, Martin Sheen.
Well. The dignity of, those are celebrities that now, like, I mean, I guess it's not like celebrities have stopped doing voiceovers for ads, but I was like, I mean, and Kathleen Turner, who is, and Martin Sheen, they both have very distinct, pleasing voices. So, you know, it's not surprising. It's just like, why do soda commercials always want us to fuck the sodas? I guess that's my point here.
I don't get that. I never have.
We've been watching.
Why does sex have to, like, sex has to figure into advertising all the time? But like, why soda? Why soda?
There's a very sultry Coca-Cola commercial that we've been watching all summer long, where it's playing like the va-va-voom music with like a wet Coke bottle, very close-up shots of it. That like all season I've been like, why is this happening? Why are we watching this? This is not what I want from a soda. Not that I even want a soda anymore, but even if I am interested in a soda, it's not because I want to be more than friends with it. You know, I want to. And so Kathleen Turner, who's got one of the sultriest, sexiest voices of all time, of course, doing Diet Dr. Pepper. I mean, damn. Like, you know what else Kathleen Turner's voice was used for? I believe it was like a countdown on Bravo of like the sexiest movie scenes of all time. So, like.
Well, it's because she was uncredited as Jessica Rabbit in Who Framed
That's
Roger
right.
Rabbit. That's why. Because she didn't take a credit for that, which is bonkers to me.
Yeah,
but
not everybody. There was still a. Who knows why, but yeah, bonkers to me as well. Well, that was a little sample of what awaits us as far as advertisements go. I guess we'll get to the actual baseball games. We'll power through because we've got three of these games to go through, and we've got so many commercials to talk about. So, game three of the 93 NLCS was Tom Glavine versus Terry Mulholland. Glavine was actually his career stats in the NLCS to this point, which tells you how, you know, much success the Braves were having at this point, that Tom Glavine was able to have so many NLCS stats. But he was 0-4 with a 6.33 ERA in the NLCS thus far. So, yeah, woof. The home plate umpire for the day, he's viewed as the biggest pitcher's umpire on the crew, which was bad news, supposedly, for the walk-heavy Phillies, because they did, you know, come to think of it, they probably had an offense very similar to what the current take in baseball is, where it relies so much on walks, strikeouts, and home runs. This is a team that was very good at getting on base via the walk, and it was said before the game that was bad news for them with the pitcher's umpire behind the plate. And to put an exclamation point on that, Dykstra goes down on three pitches to start the game on a called third strike that is liberal at best and truthfully off the plate by about 6 inches. So that was a bad sign for the Phillies, though, of course, you know, we can talk about bad signs all we want. We know how this ends. So Jim Fregosi says, of course, prior to the game, there's no carryover or momentum from a 14-3 loss. And I don't know, Liz, what's your take on momentum? In a series, you have to win. You have to be the first team to win four games of. And you lose the second game 14-3 to even the series at 1-1. 14-3. You lose a game by 11 runs in October in the playoffs. The next day, you got to fly to the other team's field and be the away team in your, like, okay, let's not lose our minds here. Let's come back and win a game. I don't know. I feel like it does. I feel like momentum, there is momentum in that.
Well, I was reading about that after the Yankees experienced, you know, the worst, you know, postseason loss in their history. I don't even remember the score, but it was obscene. The Yankees lost by a lot. And I think someone said I think one of the coaches said, you know, in some ways it's easier to shake off a loss like that because, you know, there was no hope for most of the game. You were able to just sort of say, all right, well, that's over. Let's put it behind us, as opposed to like a close loss where you've done a whole ton of things wrong. You know, you not a ton of things, but you could sort of pick out the moments where everything went wrong. Like if I had been, you know, 2 inches to the left, I would have caught that ball or something. So, you know, I think momentum matters. But I also think that in a way that some of these, you know, a really terrible loss can be easier to shake off.
Yeah. If you're losing a game by 11 runs, chances are you have already accepted losing it, you know, before it is over. So you kind of are over it. I get that you can be over it quicker because you're not waiting till the game ends to confirm the score. So I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, they were losing 9-2 by the sixth inning. So,
right. And they would actually go on to lose this game, game three, 9-4 as well. So they were down in the series 2-1, which sucked, I think you could say at the time, with two more games to play in Atlanta, which is outrageous when you think about how no one really considered them supposed to be here in the first place. Joe West was umpiring third. Fun little tidbit there. Fortunately, there's no other story to tell about him. It's just Joe West, unfortunately, is enough of a force of ignorance and idiocy in baseball that just mentioning he was there
force of ignorance
makes the whole thing sound so much stupider. Ron Gant led all of baseball in outfielder errors. Didn't know that, but he was playing in the outfield for the Braves. He was playing in left field. And I hesitated to use this word earlier because I was planning to use it now. So I'll just use it twice in one podcast and it's fine, Liz. It's totally fine. The incestuous world of baseball continued as Terry Pendleton made a spearing backhand stop of a Dave Hollins grounder at third. And the broadcast credited that stop and Terry Pendleton's defense in general to Jim Fregosi, whose defensive tutelage of Pendleton in the minors made him a pretty deft third baseman after he had started his career playing at second base. And I don't know, it might have been with you, it might have been with Trevor, but on one of these podcasts, we just do so many, we have so much to say about the Phillies. We discussed, it was us here on this podcast, actually. We discussed the differences between the 2008 and 1993 managers, Charlie Manuel and Jim Fregosi, and we both learned a lot about Jim Fregosi, about how he was, whereas Charlie was certainly a hitting guru, Jim Fregosi was much more of a defensive whiz and came up as a defensive player and was, I don't think you hear about that as often, and that there was such a yin and yang composite comparison to make between the two was really interesting to me. And it should be no surprise then that any players he coached got better on defense or were able to adapt a little better, but I didn't, you know, there's another attachment. He's sitting there watching his players trying to get a ball past the infield that he coached into being as good a defender as they've all come to be. Probably, I don't know, that kind of thing probably doesn't cross managers' minds. You know, maybe they're not thinking of all the serendipitous little narratives out on the field like some of us, but, you know, just an interesting tidbit I found. The broadcast makes references to Dionne Warwick and the Psychic Friends hotline, which jumped out at me as a very pure 1993 reference.
So early 90s.
Tim McCarver. Oh, our favorite topic on this podcast. Tim McCarver brought up that Lenny Dykstra had only weighed 140 pounds out of high school and then said, look at those arms. He's got some set of guns on him.
Geez, I wonder what happened.
No mention at all of what process Lenny Dykstra underwent to get those arms or why he had deflated at some point in the middle of the season, all of his water weight.
Did you notice that Tim McCarver has a hard time calling Lenny Dykstra Lenny? He always calls him Len.
That must just be, I don't know. I mean, they probably had a working relationship. I'm sure I'm sure that's just what he called him. Maybe not everyone was allowed to call him Len.
Maybe. I also made a note while I was, you know, watching clips this week that Lenny Dykstra somehow looks like the cartoon version of himself on steroids. Like, I'm also confused that the pants are indecent
tight
on some of these men. They are, it's, it's like their body paint or they're just wearing leggings. Like, I can see every detail of Lenny Dykstra's ass, and I don't
he wanted
want
you
to.
That's the difference. He wanted you to know every detail of his ass. That was that. Lenny Dykstra was broadcasting his ass to the world in 1993.
It's terrible. I'm looking at, like, I can't look directly at it.
Well, fortunately, the broadcast was not 3 hours of Lenny Dykstra's ass, though it did certainly feel like it whenever he was on screen. In the same breath, Tim McCarver also then suggested that Tommy Lasorda should be the commissioner of baseball.
No!
What a time to be alive.
I can't.
Can you imagine?
Wow.
Just consider that scenario where Tommy Lasorda wouldn't even know how to like turn on his computer.
Tommy Lasorda is essentially a bridge troll.
He's like, when I think about how I don't care who wins the World Series this year, I just think about how the Dodgers winning would make Tommy Lasorda happy. And that's enough for me to want the Red Sox to win.
Yeah. I got an email recently from the PR person who handles Lasorda Family Wines.
Go on.
All they want to know is, do you want to write about it? Could we send you samples? And I'm going to respond, yes. You want to send me a bottle of wine? Go for it. I will drink your crappy Lasorda wine.
I'll write about it in my...
I mean, I will reserve judgment. I'm reserving judgment until they give it to me.
They must be pretty confident how good it is if they're willing to send it to you for free and risk that you'd write a terrible review of it.
Yeah, right? I will respond to them and report back for sure.
Well, Tommy Lasorda did not become the commissioner of baseball. You'll be surprised to learn. But some history was made that night, Liz, in the top of the fourth when John Kruk and Mariano Duncan hit back-to-back first pitch triples in the fourth. And this was the first time in league championship history that there had been that had happened, which is, not difficult to believe. But more so difficult to believe, John Kruk hitting a triple. That just seems... out of character.
Yeah.
But he tripled in Mariano Duncan in the fourth, gave the Phillies a 1-0 lead that would not last, unfortunately. Because in the bottom of the sixth, the Braves tore into Terry Mulholland. And this was after, again, John Kruk led off the top of the sixth with a home run. So he was trying to carry the team himself, trying to carry that offense that was having trouble hitting Tom Glavine that night. And he gave them a 2-0 lead. But then in the bottom of the sixth, the Braves just Fred McGriff hit the first RBI single off Terry Mulholland, and it was kind of a brutal start to the inning. Starting with Jeff Blauser, it went single, walk, single, single, double, and at that point the Braves had scored four times. The first single to lead off the inning was just a little weak little ground ball just to Terry Mulholland's left that he just could not get to in time. And after the Ron Gant walk, that's when the real hitting started. And things got brutal pretty quick because Mulholland got yanked. Roger Mason was put into the game. And then Mark Lemke managed to reach on a ground ball to second base on the second baseman. And that allowed David Justice to score. So at that point, it's 5-2 after a complete meltdown of an inning. So Jim Fregosi, as the broadcast was saying, manages aggressively or power man. They also called it power managing, which I'm not familiar with that term. I think they were saying it's because he doesn't bunt or hit and run much because his lineup has too much power, which, okay. I mean, if you saw somebody doing that today, I'm sure there would be a lot of debate about it, whether it was a power lineup or not, what a power lineup actually is, who in it was actually a power hitter and what isn't. I mean, you can just picture all the ways this was being picked. This could be picked apart today, but I don't know. I mean, it seems more appealing to me. I feel like I've reached this point where in this debate that always comes down to, in broadest possible terms, old school versus new school, like that whole thing. We're going to be having that argument for years now with Gabe Kapler as the manager of the Phillies. I think I've just landed in this place where I know it's right to involve analytics in the measurement of your baseball team's skill and in the way you implement them. And it all comes down to that. And it's a combination of gut instinct and analytic. I know that's right. But obviously, if you had a team full of guys who could all hit home runs, I mean, that's what you want, right? Like that's the most fun. That's the lineup you want. Like you don't have that lineup most of the time, and you have a lineup that needs to be managed in all these nuanced ways that aren't as, you know, it's not fun to watch somebody employ analytics, watch them make a bunch of pitching changes or use the left fielder as the second baseman based on, I get why they're doing it and I support it, that if the numbers say it and it's worked in the past and it makes sense through common sense, then yeah, okay, let's go for it. But this is like what you want as a kid, right? A lineup full of guys who can mash, who take turns trying to hit the crap out of the ball. And in this case, for the 93 Phils, it working to the point that they go all the way to the World Series. I mean, isn't that the ideal scenario as a fan of baseball?
Exactly. Yes. I mean, that's what that is. Yes. What else are those guys are going to do? That's why the team was such a huge, you know, why everyone stuck to them. They were like the dream, the weird baseball dream team. You know, you think of a dream team in some sports and what that might look like in baseball. And for certain types of fans, this is what the dream team looked like. So it's exactly what you want.
Other things that turn me off of bunting, even though, look, if you're a good bunter, if you're a fast runner and a good bunter, like, yeah, that's awesome. Like, use those skills. But hearing Tim McCarver describe bunting was another reason not to do it, I would say, given that he described bunting as, quote, using the bat as a glove and, quote, trying to catch the ball with the bat, which, look.
That's a very good impression, actually.
That's not really the worst characterization in the world, but I don't know, man. Coming out of Tim McCarver's mouth, the word salads he's produced in the past, it's just kind of, it just intrinsically nonsense.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's just like a bag of words that he just sort of, you know, reached out his hand and gave you.
I honestly, yeah. And Tim McCarver not being in the booth anymore. We talked about his timelessness, given that he's part of both our 93 and 2008 stories. Not being in the booth anymore is one of the biggest differences in watching the World Series anymore. We don't have to get too much into this because I'm sure we both have a lot to say about it. I mean, I don't think John Smoltz is very good at being the color man alongside Joe Buck. I think there's plenty of other more interesting people and less angry people to come out and talk about postseason baseball. But Tim McCarver not being there is one of the big differences. Another big difference that I noticed watching a rerun of this game, and I'm not sure if you did the same thing, but Otis Nixon steals a base in the fifth inning of game three. And it's close, and you're just kind of wondering, you're just waiting for the review. And then you realize it's not going to happen because it's 1993. And I don't know, back then there was almost like there was a, when a close play went your way, there was a sense of intense relief. And I mean this even, not in even like just the 90s. I mean, just a couple of years ago before replay was a normal part of baseball. There was a satisfaction and a sense of relief knowing like, okay, and it can't be reversed. They called it. I don't care if it's wrong. If it went our way, then it's irreversible. It's fine. Like, it can't be. And I'm not saying that was a good thing, because when it didn't go your way, it was infuriating and clearly something was broken in baseball that they still haven't totally fixed. But, you know, there was a, if you're looking for a silver lining and not having replay, it was when they blew a call and it went in your team's favor, then that was still the call. I don't know. Is that am I starting to sound too much like I've faded away into the old school world?
Oh, no. Like, that's one of the reasons that, you know, you can hate and love replay in one, you know, in one game, in one inning, you know, because a call goes your way and the other team challenges it and it's actually not your way and you get something taken away. But you can always also have something given to you. You sort of have to look at it on balance, I guess, because I completely see why people don't like it. I would just rather get everything right, even if it's not, you know, in my team's favor, which I say now, having no stake in like the World Series or whatever. So when the World Series comes around and the Phillies get screwed over on a close play that was called their way and is overturned, I'm sure I'll change my mind entirely. You heard it here first.
I mean, yeah, it's easy to make these statements and you don't have when your team's not playing. But I'm with you. Like, looking at it and thinking about it more and more, it was like, yeah, that was a relief to know that that was locked in. But then again, we spent many years watching, it felt like, the wrong team get the right call. And I know I was irrationally vocal against umpires for too long to not be someone who was like, we need replay. And they do need replay. That's very true. I'm just suggesting that perhaps in the absence of replay, there was a positive angle to that, but not one that really makes sense objectively. Well, at the same time as this game was going on, Liz, across the street, the Braves' new stadium was still a pile of dirt. It wouldn't be. They were playing in I believe, Fulton County Stadium. And this new stadium, Liz, it wouldn't be ready until after the 1996 Olympics. I know as a big fan of the Olympics, you'd enjoy hearing mention of that, which, wouldn't be for between 2 and 3 years at this point. But after the 96 Olympics, when the Braves started using it, it would stand tall as the Braves' proud home for, what was it, like a decade and a half? For like 15 years before they...
Something like that. It wasn't very long. Just they just replaced it
the briefest
last few years.
Blink of a legacy. Ah, yeah. Good times. And everyone loves the Cobb County Stadium, and there have been no issues whatsoever with the way the Braves have gone about building it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no problems at all. Everyone's happy. Nothing is wrong.
Speaking
they
of
certainly
nothing,
didn't screw anybody out of money. Oh, no.
Speaking of nothing being wrong, my favorite part of the Game 3 of the 93 NLCS, the broadcast told us that two nights before, two guys in Philly had stolen the CBS sports banner, and the broadcast announced rather huffily that anyone who steals the banner again wouldn't be shown on TV. So they were assuring any would-be thieves they wouldn't get any notoriety out of it. And in Atlanta, they hung it and it was locked into place with like new security measures to avoid theft, and was also I think I heard this right, was also being heated to the point that it was hot to the touch, so you couldn't grab it and run away with it. Someone in Philadelphia walked off with the CBS sports banner to the point that they changed security protocol for the CBS sports banner. I mean, way to go, Philly.
Wow.
Do you think that that's hanging?
Oh, I love that. That's great.
Do you think that's hanging in someone's basement somewhere?
God, I hope so.
If you have the CBS,
I hope it's hanging someone's banner. It's been passed down from father to son to, you know, to father to daughter.
If you have the massive CBS sports banner from the 1993 NLCS at Veterans Stadium, please contact this podcast. We'd love to talk to you.
We'll keep your identity a secret.
But why would you want it to be, honestly?
I don't know. They might want it back.
That shit would be on my LinkedIn page if I had that thing. Oh, my God. So the game comes apart in the sixth when the Braves, like I said, tee off on Mulholland and string together five straight hits. Liz, McCarver reminds us that walks don't count as hits. Just so you know that. I know that you get confused. But yeah,
so useful. I'm so glad you filled everyone in on that.
So the Braves go up 2-1 after a 9-4 victory at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. Game four occurs on the next night, October 10th. And the Phillies are, you know, it's not technically a must-win situation, but it's one of those non-must-win games that they were almost certainly calling must-win games. Speaking of John Smoltz, he was at this game, Liz, because he was the losing pitcher of it and not the bored, angry man sitting in a glass cube above it talking about how much he hates it. There was a bizarre moment scored that resulted in the scoring of the Braves' only run of Game 4. Mark Lemke hit a line drive down the third baseline in the second. It was clearly a fair ball by about a foot, but the umpire was trying to get out of the way of the ball and had his back to the play. Also, so he turned around while getting out of the way of the ball. So the direction he was pointing became the opposite direction because he turned around while still pointing. So he was somehow signaling that it was fair and foul at the same time. And it was like, because he had to turn around to stop pointing, he was pointing fair and then foul. Then he threw both arms up in the air and nobody knew what the hell was going on. But fortunately, Milt Thompson never stopped chasing the ball, though, so they held the rally to a single run. Regardless, Fregosi came out to yell and scream at the ump for good reason, but at the same time, it came down to Milt Thompson. He could have stopped chasing the ball, and the Braves would have just been circling the bases, and as we just discussed, you know, it was harder to go back on a play, even if it was crazy like that at this point, so without using replay. So really, it's great that Milt Thompson treated that like it was a live play, because it turned out that's what they were calling it, instead of getting confused by the umpire, and managed to get the ball in fast enough that the Braves didn't score beyond that single run in the bottom of the second. So, you know, weird umpire events, not limited to Mookie Betts jumping into the stands in 2018. This was certainly certainly a moment that they were probably talking about in the bar the next day. But in any case, the Phillies tied it up in the fourth on a sack fly by the eight-hole hitter, Kevin Stocker. And the go-ahead run brought in by Danny Jackson. Phillies pitcher, an 077 hitter in the regular season, on a ground ball up the middle. That was the Phillies rally that inning. Darren Dalton leading off, reaching on an error. Milt Thompson doubles him over to third, and then Stocker hits a sack fly. Danny Jackson hits a ground ball up the middle. And those are their runs. That's how they scored those runs. And they went up 2-1 with, you know, five more innings to play, in which nothing else occurred. And the Phillies won the game 2-1, which is absurd. And they managed to hold on to that lead with a miracle in the ninth inning. Mitch Williams fields a bunt with runners on first and second. It's to the left of the mound, so Williams goes to third, which is always a gamble, where Kim Batiste has to lurch pretty much the full extension of his body to make the catch. Somehow holds the bag, somehow, and gets the out at third. At regular speed, it doesn't look like he makes that play at all. At regular speed, it looks like the runner is safe, and that there's just, I mean, you know what safe looks like watching at home. You know what that typically looks like when it's like, oh, okay, he didn't beat it. You learn early on, like that shot, you know, when it's close enough that it looks like they might have beaten it, but they didn't, or when they do, and it looks like he's safe at third. But he wasn't, and they slowed down the footage, and he was clearly out. Batiste managed to keep his foot on the bag. And if he hadn't, you know, game over. Game over, series basically over. The next batter grounded into a double play, and the game and the series were saved. The Phillies won the game 2-1, which, again, very unlikely outcome to me, given how good the Braves were, how shaky the Phillies' late-game pitching was, and how gassed some of their relievers were at this point, and the fact that Kim Batiste, who is, you know, a defensive specialist replacement, but still a backup guy, having to make a play like that. I mean, again, this is how the Phillies lived and died in 1993 with all the Kim Batistes coming through, when you're just like, really? Seriously? Mariano Duncan hit a grand slam? Shit like that just happened all year, and this was just another example of that. And with this and the walk-off hit Batiste had earlier in the NLCS, I mean, we could probably find something else Kim Batiste did to, if you really need it, but at this point, he's saved two games that they would have lost otherwise. Nobody really talks about him. I don't know. Maybe because it wasn't like it wasn't enough to be MVP, and he wasn't even playing in every game. But still, those are two huge plays that if they go the other way, the Phillies probably lose two games that were obviously crucial to them winning the series. So I don't know. I mean, let's go back a little bit. Liz, who's the worst hitter you've ever seen come through in a playoff series?
Oh, that's a good question. The worst.
Let's say
I feel like Cody Ross comes to my mind immediately.
Well, that's a whole other.
I'm sorry. Listen, he exists in our history and we have to talk about him because, you know, he's there. He sucked. He looked like a sad hobo clown.
I honestly, balloon. I mean, we don't even have to limit it to Phillies series.
Oh, I know, but that's just the first thing that came to mind.
I mean, I would say Michael Martinez, but he actually doesn't have a hit. He doesn't have a postseason hit in his career. And he's appeared in four different postseason series, Liz. Michael Martinez. Michael Martinez, you want to, you know how many postseason series Roy Halladay appeared in?
One.
Two, actually. It was 2010 and 2011. So technically three series.
Oh, you're right.
They appeared in two series in 2010, but still less than Michael Martinez. right place, right time. 2011 Phillies and the 2016 Indians. But yeah, he's 0-4 every time he's ever. He's appeared in four games or four series. Only has four at bats and did not walk or get a hit in any of them, and actually has three strikeouts. So he's the worst player who has never come through, we could say. But yeah, I'm talking like guy like Danny Jackson, position like a position player with a pitcher's batting average coming through with a big knock. And I know there's an answer. I know there's an answer to this. I just I'm having trouble coming up with, even just in the past couple of years. I know there's a terrible field. And it's funny when you don't watch a team all year long and then they are on the national stage for the length of the postseason and it's a team you're not familiar with, and one of their terrible guys just catches fire and is like good for the entire postseason. And you're just like, wow, that guy's good. I can't believe that's somebody I like wasn't aware of because he plays on the West Coast or whatever. Like I wasn't aware. And then you go back and look at his regular season stats and he's got like an OPS of 440 and you're like, oh, so he's like terrible. And he's one of those guys who has a demon inside him and he's just Cody Rossing through the playoffs. Okay. I see what's happening here. But yeah, that's pretty much how the 93 Phillies made their bread, was by relying on guys who you probably shouldn't rely on. Well, in any case, they came back the following night after going down 2-1 in the series and won 2-1, beating John Smoltz, a pitcher who's very difficult to beat at this point, and even the series at 2-2, which brought them to Game 5 on October 11th, also in Atlanta. I mean, this was, again, another huge game because the Phillies, they lost those two games in a row. I mean, damn, that is, you lose two games in a row, one by 11 runs and one by 5 runs, and then you still have two more games to play at the other stadium. I mean, that's brutal. That's rough. I don't know. It's kind of amazing they were able to hold on, because they not only won 2-1 against John Smoltz, but then won by one run the next night too. And this was not a team that was, I don't know. I mean, they tended to blow a lot of teams out with a powerful offense rather than being able to like hold tight leads. That wasn't exactly their forte. But they got 8 innings out of Curt Schilling, which helped a lot, because when their starting pitching was able to go deep and hold teams, that was when they were able to make a smaller amount of runs stand up. In this game, saw the first, certainly not the first, saw another hint of Mitch Williams' inability to close out games despite being the closer. Liz, you and I lived through Brad Lidge in 2009, which on the dirty inning with Trevor, we referred to Brad Lidge in 2009 as Bad Lidge, because we were picking out the worst games of each World Series the Phillies have appeared in, and the one in 2009 that they lost. One of the ones in 2009 that they lost to the Yankees featured a Brad Lidge meltdown, and he was very bad in 2009. Part of that is because you're coming off the heels of the perfect season in 2008, where he could do no wrong and did no wrong. But part of it is that he just had a really crappy year, and all season long, you and me and everyone are sitting there going like, you know, you got Ryan Madsen, try somebody else. And, you know, one obvious parallel between Charlie Manuel and Jim Fregosi is that they had their guys. They were old school, certainly, and that was no different when they came to guys having jobs. If you were one of their guys, you had a job. And Brad Lidge didn't lose his job, and Mitch Williams never lost his job, and they both had very similar quotes, but you and I lived through the Brad Lidge is our closer days, and Mitch Williams was Jim Fregosi's closer. So I don't know. Do you feel like... would you rather have a manager who let me ask you a more interesting question, because obviously if you're bad enough, eventually you're going to lose your job, no matter who your manager is. It's just a matter of how long. How long would you let a closer blow games before you replaced him? And let's set this up that it's the context. It's a closer who is legitimately, he's your closer. This isn't his first year or anything. He's been established as a closer. He's got some good years behind him, but he blows four games in 1 month. And then the next month he starts off by blowing the next game. I mean, like, it's a situation like that. Where how long is the rope that you give a closer?
In the playoffs, it's not very long.
It can't be, right?
No. like there, some things are, excuse me, some things are unique. You know, there's what's happening with Craig Kimbrell this year, who was having a hard time, and Alex Cora, who's not an old school manager, he's not an old school guy, you know, continued to go to him, you know, while Red Sox fans everywhere just sort of lost their mind. But, you know, they sort of figured out what was happening. He was tipping some pitches, they fixed some mechanical issues, and he's, you know, he was much better. They barely needed him. And so, you know, I that doesn't seem like it's, maybe that is normal, but I wouldn't have a long rope. That you, these are World Series games. These are NLCS games. You lose too many and you are done. Your season is over so close to the goal. So, you know, the guy has a job, but if he's not doing it, the point is to find someone who can. You have a whole bullpen full of dudes who could do the same thing.
I mean, yeah, it's tough to argue with because, like, I'm trying to set it up for in the regular season. How long do you give a closer before he loses his job? But in the playoffs, it can't be more than, you know, a couple of hits because you're playing with – it's a razor's edge. Like, you lose, like we just talked about how Kim Batiste saved two games and no one talks about it because, you know, it's just how you got to play it in the playoffs is that everything feels like a game-saving moment. Especially you get into like the seventh, eighth inning, especially as you get into games 4, 5, and 6, you know, like that's, it's everything matters. And having a reliever who you rely on and like come in and start giving up hits and runs, that can't last long because any lead is too much. And in game 5, the Phillies went up early 1-0 in the first inning. John Kruk just on fire for this series, doubles in Mariano Duncan in the first inning. Phillies go up 1-0. Wes Chamberlain hits a sack fly after Pete Incaviglia reaches on an error in the fourth. Phillies go up 2-0. At that point, in the top of the ninth, they've held this 2-0 score all game long. Kurt Schilling is laying them down 3, 4, at most 5 hitters in an inning. Darren Dalton comes up, hits a home run to give the Phillies an insurance run. So it's 3-0 going into the bottom of the ninth. And Kurt Schilling's still in the game. And he gives a leadoff walk to Jeff Blauser. Then Ron Gant reaches on an error. So Mitch Williams comes in to close things out. And like, that's what he's supposed to be there for. You leave Kurt Schilling in because you're like, maybe he's got enough gas. Again, he's one of Jim Fregosi's guys. He's pitching really effectively. And he could save the bullpen for the rest of the series. Any relief you can save the bullpen is obviously also valuable. And that's why you have Mitch Williams because well, that's why you have your closer, certainly not Mitch Williams. That's why you have your closer to come in because he's literally there to like, okay, he's going to end the game. He's got like lights out stuff that gets 3 outs and that's what he's there for. And Mitch Williams just seemed incapable of getting 3 outs most of the time. And this was no exception. He comes in and allows a single to Fred McGriff, a sack fly to David Justice, both of which score runs. That's 2 runs. So now it's 3-2. Suddenly the lead is down to 1 run. Took the Phillies all game long to build a 3-run lead. And Mitch Williams just turns it into a 1-run lead within 2 hitters without recording an out. Gives up a single to Terry Pendleton. Still hasn't recorded an out. Gives up an RBI single to Francisco Cabrera. Now the game's tied. Then he finally records his first out, striking out Mark Lemke. Then Bill Pecota is batting and he flies out to center field. So the inning's finally over. I'm sorry. The strikeout wasn't his first out. I forgot the sack fly counts as an out. But still, still very bad. He blows a 3-0 lead within minutes. It's tied 3-3 in the ninth inning, and we got to go to the 10th. And now the Phillies have to face the Braves closer, Mark Wohlers, who is also very good. And fortunately for them, Lenny Dykstra comes up with 1 out and hits a solo home run. Gives them back a 4-3 lead, and you better believe Mitch Williams isn't coming back into this game, though. Hell, would you have been surprised? I mean, they kept him in after giving up all those runs. What, Mitch Williams, again, this is bizarre to think about now. Mitch Williams still in the game after giving up 3 runs, which is also the lead, and still needing 2 more outs, still in the game. Can you imagine, did Gabe Kapler leave any pitcher in for that long?
No. You could barely convince him to leave starters in the length that they should be.
Yeah. For the third time through the batting order. Like this would you, maybe the definition of your guy, like a manager being one of his guys was certainly different then. I mean, the game was clearly different. You're still seeing reflections that like back in the day, a pitcher's job was to come in and pitch and he pitched until he literally couldn't pitch anymore. And you brought in another guy. You weren't thinking about who the batters he was going to face were. You were just like, okay, who's another good pitcher we have back there who can pitch? But in this case, I don't know, there's shades of that. That's very old school to be like, all right, bring him in. Well, he didn't give up. The Braves aren't winning now. It's just tied. Leave Mitch in there. See if you can figure it out. Or like, I don't want to insult Mitch by taking him out now. I don't want to shake his confidence.
Insult. Yeah, because that's what it's all about. Let's not insult the guy who is giving up our chance to go to the World Series.
So Larry Anderson comes in for the bottom of the 10th, and he sets the Braves down in order. He sets down Otis Nixon, Jeff Blauser, and Ron Gant. He actually gets Blauser and Grant on strikeouts. And the game is over. The Phillies win 4-3 in 10, which shouldn't have had to have happened, but goddamn, that was a portrait of things to come, certainly, in the form of Mitch Williams blowing a lead. So finally, it's game six. Finally, they're back in Philadelphia. The Phillies have a chance to win the series and go on to the World Series in the most unlikely of spots, having to not only face the Braves in the NLCS, having been in last place in 1992, having won two of these games in the 10th inning by a score of 4-3, having lost two games in a row to go down 2-1 in this series by wide margins, one of which being a total blowout, one of which being at home. They're still managing to be up 3-2 in this series by the time game six rolls around. And this is on October 13th, 1993. The Phillies have a chance to go to their first World Series in a decade. And of course, you know, we know how that goes. They do it. And they do it, Liz. I know you're on the edge of your seat.
They lots of doing it. They do it. They may not have finished doing it, but they sure as shooting did some
Tommy
things.
Green made the start for the Phillies. He went seven innings. Greg Maddux was on the mound for the Braves, which, again, how did they beat this team? He only lasted 5 2/3 and gave up 5 earned runs and 4 walks. So clearly he didn't come to the park with his best stuff. Darren Dalton knocked in the first runs with a 2-run double in the bottom of the third after Tommy Green led off the inning with a walk, which, you know, pitchers working walks, huge part of Phillies playoff history. Dalton knocks in 2 runs with a double. Jeff Blauser cuts it in half in the top of the fifth with a single. There's an error on the left fielder. I mean, there's a ton of errors in this series, I feel like. But that allows a run to score. But then Dave Hollins hits a home run to make it 4-1 in the bottom of the fifth. Mickey Morandini with the killing stroke. 2-run triple in the bottom of the sixth. That gives the Phillies a 6-1 lead. Tommy Green gives up a home run to Jeff Blauser to make it 6-3. But that's all she wrote. Mitch Williams comes in, puts down the Braves, 1-2-3, you know, okay, no worries there. He gets Damon Berryhill striking out to start the inning, then strikes out Bill Pakoda to end the series and send the Phillies to the World Series, which just an amazing, just, you know, having traced this series, this season, all season long, it is just, I get why, we all know culturally why Philadelphia glommed onto this team. And what this team was like, but just from a, just disregarding that component of it, kind of an incredible season that this, any of this happened. And even just the NLCS alone that they went on to beat the Braves is just incredible. Like they should not, they had no business beating that team. And,
at all.
So
makes me happy that it happened because again, fuck the Braves. But
of course we're happy it happened. But now let's get to the really important component as we close out here. Liz, the commercials. Gave you a sample with the Kathleen Turner and the soda fucking preview to start off the episode. But, I mean, I don't know if you have a list of ads you wrote down before we started talking. But I have a couple that we can go over. For instance, the most 90s commercial. I mean, some of these I would write down and be like, this is the most 90s commercial. But I don't know if you saw this. I'm sure you did. It was one of the only ones that was on and on and on and on. But the cornflakes commercial brought to you by a deaf girl
with a side
ponytail, which first of all, I was like, representation. Awesome. But side ponytail. And they still get her to sign the words psych and gag me. Like that was pretty 90s.
That was amazing. It was just amazing. I love that. There was the Burger King. Is that House Party? Burger King House Party commercial?
Go on. I don't remember this one.
You didn't see this?
Yeah, I might have looked right past it.
Oh my God. I mean, it was obviously very much a tie-in, but like they weren't even offering any kind of special tie-in. It was just like clips from the movie and then, hey, have our burgers.
Wait. Which movie?
House Party.
Oh, God. I thought you were saying, yes, I do remember that. I thought you were just saying like a Burger King commercial where there was a house party. Now I understand.
No, the movie,
yes,
House Party.
I remember that. Yeah. And they very much didn't bother to bridge the gap between the two things they were trying to sell. Yeah, that was pretty. And that would have written itself, I feel like, you know, having a house party at Burger King, blah, 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 blah. Like, no, didn't bother too much. Yeah. I'd forgotten all about the.
There's the dog. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's talk about the Diet Dr. Pepper commercial with like the sexy bridge operator.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sex was really selling in the 90s, especially soda.
Weird again.
I mean,
so strange.
You want to talk about sexy? I saw one for Brute Fragrance where a guy takes off his shirt to fix a car. And the company reminded us, and I believe this was their catchphrase, that, quote, men are back.
Oh, are they now?
Men are back, Liz.
So glad
we went away.
Where did they go?
We all went away for a while to talk about how to fix cars, but we figured it out and we're back now and we don't have our shirts and we're really ready to fix stuff. So give me that wrench and I'll take care of this. Men are back. Don't worry.
Can we
calm down?
Can we send you back from, can you go back?
Can we get other men?
Can you all visit more time? Because I mean, I don't know about other people or women, but I wouldn't say no to that, really.
But we all smell different now. We got this fragrance on, we got our shirts off. I mean, I don't know what else you want from a man. I'm looking at this car. I gotta tell you, I don't have any idea how to fix it, but you enjoy my scent while I go about work piecing this together.
I was impressed with the number of themed commercials. I watched a few commercials on the World Series as well, so I'm trying not to mix them up because I'm sure there'll be some difference. But and I forgot exactly what I just said. I have to apologize. I took some cold medicine a while
Hell
ago.
Hell yeah, Liz, this is the party.
I'm really sorry.
We're gonna transition right into continued success after dark on this one. Just hit a few more cold medicines, and then we're gonna be good to go. But yeah.
Yeah, like 2 hours ago, I sneezed 5 times in a row, and I don't know why.
I get the chunk off medicine now.
I've been stuffy ever since, and I'm just like, well, I should take some cold medicine. I'm like, oh, God, I have a podcast to record.
Well, when you say themes.
Themed commercials. Yeah, I was impressed by the themed commercials.
So when you say themes, what do you mean when you say that they were themed?
Baseball.
Oh, I see.
That's a baseball theme. Commercials. Then there were the commercials from Major League Baseball itself with the tagline "Catch the Fever."
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I loved the "Catch the Fever" campaign. That was terrific. And Liz, you caught the fever right before the podcast. It's just watching a little bit of old ads and the fever baseball was trying to warn us about 25 years ago. You caught it. Wow. How's it feel?
Yes. Oh, it feels gross and I don't like it.
Yeah, that's baseball. That's the right feeling. Yeah, that's how it feels.
Yum. I caught two TV commercials. I know there were more. I have one saved for our World Series episode, but there were commercials for Evening Shade.
Yep.
Do you ever watch Evening Shade?
I watched the opening credits and a few scenes of Evening Shade after watching that commercial for Evening Shade and wondering what the hell that was. But I found out.
We used to watch that.
Yeah, that was.
There's Dave's World. Mm-hmm. With the recently departed
judge from Night Court, right?
Yes, yeah. Thank you. I know his name, and I hear Harry something. But yeah, he was also on Cheers. He was great. But yeah, this was his Dave Barry based sitcom, which ran about 4 years and is available nowhere. I watched probably every episode of this while it was airing because it's just what we watched at the house. You know, it was on after something or whatever. But yeah,
Harry,
we watched
Anderson.
This. Harry Anderson. Yes. Harry Anderson. He was the best. This was like the last thing he did in TV before he just retired.
Yeah. I when I saw that it was based on Dave Barry, I was like, oh boy. The opening credits were animated, which I think was a huge thing in the 90s.
Oh yeah. With that, you may be right.
Yes.
I haven't, by the way, I have not watched the credits to this show in at least 15 years and I still know a lot about them. This is the type of shit that does not leave my brain.
I had forgotten about the Dean Witter investments commercials, where it was like the founder of Dean Witter, who I guess was Dean Witter, standing in a conference room in like black and white distorted footage being like, we measure success one investor at a time. And I forgot SNL parodied those with the guy who in Billy Madison does the "We are all dumber now for having listened to you. I award you no points. And may God have mercy on your soul."
Yes.
The guy who does that speech and shows up in all those. He's a writer for SNL for many years. And he plays that same guy in the parody of those commercials where they just, I don't know, I think they just say weird, ridiculous shit, which that stuff was, my first thought was, how can you make fun of this? And I was like, oh, right, people did professionally because it was that mockable and hilarious. Liz, the CBS movie of the week was Days of Thunder, which CBS described as torn between his passion for a woman and his lust for speed. Talking about Tom Cruise.
Yeah, Tom Cruise Nicole Kidman and his passion for women. I just, believe it.
Yeah, that was,
who doesn't believe that? Watch Top Gun and tell me you don't believe that Tom Cruise has passion for women.
I don't think that was the actual movie's tagline. I think that was CBS jumping in there and being like, how can we get people to watch this while they're fucking their sodas? How are they going to be into this? We got to make it as sexy as possible, you know, like a soda commercial. But, you know, not as erotic. The CBS was all about airing its own commercials for its own broadcasting. They called CBS This Morning their morning show. They referred to it as breakfast for your head.
Oh, no.
How do you feel about that?
I don't think I want to.
That was weird, right?
Breakfast.
Did a bunch of 90s drugs and started writing catchphrases for their morning talk show. I tweeted out a screenshot of this because I found it so utterly hilarious. But the CBS was doing a special on Hitler and Stalin that was only going to play if the NLCS didn't go to like another game. Hosted by General Norman Schwarzkopf. And the screen cap I tweeted just said Stalin and Hitler Wednesday, if no baseball. And it was just like, oh my God, there's a lot at risk here. I really hope there's baseball. But yeah, it was a timely, like, oh, let's look back at these two gentlemen from history. It seems like they're worthy of a mention here. Give them an hour on primetime CBS to see what they were all about. And finally, Liz, there was a 60-minute story on how women are buying guns like never before. My question for you is, Liz, as a woman, what were you guys buying all those guns for in the 90s?
We were told all the time that we should be constantly scared.
We heard men are back.
Men are back. We should be scared. Yet no one will believe us when we say they've done anything bad to us. So our only hope is to buy guns to protect ourselves, since the men who are now back refuse to.
Men are back and they're shirtless. And plus, women are buying guns like never before. Get rid of the men before they fuck your car up.
My favorite commercial might have been the commercial for MLB Rookie League clothing for kids, where the mannequins in the store, like there's like a store somewhere with an escalator that goes down to, you know, the kids department of MLB clothing. And like the lights go off for the night, the escalator stops, the old ass security guard just sits there with his hat over his eyes, and these mannequins, these kid mannequins, come alive and start throwing the ball. I'm like watching this because they don't tell you it's mannequins until the end of the commercial. I'm like, how did that little baby get in there? Who put that baby in that swing? How did any of these kids get here? And then they pull out at the end like, oh, it's mannequins. That's not creepy at all.
You know, I think a lot of times for advertising in the 90s, they just watched a horror movie and they were like, now how can we make this fun? And it was like, let's not come up with fun ideas. Let's turn horrifying ideas into fun ones, which, again, raises immediate questions like, why isn't anyone panicking that the mannequins are coming to life?
Yes, I don't understand.
Is that not everyone has that fear? Everyone. It's like clowns. There's nothing special about being afraid of mannequins coming to life because everyone's afraid of that. And Major League Baseball is like, let's use that fear to sell clothing to kids.
Lord.
Oh, any more advertisements before we close up shop here, Liz?
I don't have any more. Maybe I did at one point, but I left my notes in another room. So I've been doing this from memory because I've been taking cold medicine. I'm very sorry.
That's perfectly acceptable. We're calling Ace Podcast early because one of us took a bunch of cold medicine and left her notes in another room. No, that's we're not calling it early. Liz, you nailed it. With that being the context, I'd say you did remarkably well.
Thank you.
And that, folks, was the 1993 NLCS, commercials and all. We, of course, will be getting to the World Series. We have nothing left except the 2008 and 1993 World Series to talk about. You know, we're having such a good time describing these games to you. We haven't really decided how we're going to break down our coverage of the rest of the games. Obviously, nearing the end and the most memorable parts of both teams' seasons. We might break it up into a couple episodes. We might compress 93 into one and 2008 into another one. We haven't really decided. So it may go longer than the actual World Series, but you don't care. You'll keep listening because this is a fun podcast where we talk about things the Phillies have done. So thank you for listening and keep listening to all the podcasts in the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season with John Stolness and The Dirty Inning with myself and Trevor Strunk. And of course, our Patreon features all kinds of bonus exclusive content that you can get for $5 or $10. You can get even more exclusive content from all of us in the Good Fight podcast family. So feel free to toss us a little money if you feel like you aren't getting currently enough Phillies talking in your ear. Thank you again for listening to Continued Success, and we will talk to you next time.
Hey, everybody, how you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all Flyers, all the time show, so much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team, the Flyers.